The Dark One and all the Forsaken are bound in Shael Ghul, bound by the Creator in the moment of creation. But the Catechism did not help. She knew too well how much of it was false. Then the rest of it came home to her. 13 Myrdral. And 13 sisters of the Black Aja. She heard Elaine screaming before she realized she was screaming herself, jerking uselessly in those invisible bonds of air. It was impossible to say which was louder, their despairing screams or the laughter from Leandrin and Rihanna.
Chapter 52. In Search of a Remedy. Slumped on the stool in the Gleeman's room, Matt grimaced as Tom coughed again. How are we going to keep looking if he's so bloody sick he can't walk? He was ashamed as soon as he thought it. Tom had been as assiduous in searching as he had, pushing himself day and night when he had to know he was coming down sick. Matt had been so absorbed in his hunt that he had paid too little attention to Tom's coughing. The change from constant rain to steamy heat had not helped it. "Come on, Tom," he said. "Lopar says there's a wise woman not far. That is what they call a wisdom here, a wise woman. Wouldn't naive like that?"
"I do not need any foul-tasting concoctions poured down my throat, boy."
Tom stuffed a fist through his mustaches in a vain attempt to stop his hacking.
"You go ahead looking. Just give me a few hours on my bed, and I'll join you."
The racking wheezes doubled him over till his head was almost on his knees. "So I am supposed to do all the work while you take your ease?" Matt said lightly. "How can I find anything without you? You learn most of what we hear." That was not exactly true. Men talked as freely over dice as they did while buying a Gleeman a cup of wine. More freely than they did with a Gleeman hacking so hard they feared contagion. But he was beginning to think that Tom's cough was not going to go away by itself. "If the old goat dies on me, who will I play stones with?" he told himself roughly. "Anyway, your bloody coughing keeps me awake even in the next room." Ignoring the white-haired man's protests, he pulled Tom to his feet. He was shocked at how much of the Gleeman's weight he had to support. Despite the damp heat, Tom insisted on his patch-covered cloak. Matt had his own coat unbuttoned completely and all three ties of his shirt undone, but he let the old goat have his way. No one in the common room even looked up as he half-carried Tom out into the muggy afternoon. The innkeeper had given simple directions, but when they reached the gate and faced the mud of the mola, Matt almost turned back to ask another wise woman. There had to be more than one in a city this size. Tom's wheezing decided him. With a grimace, Matt stepped off into the mud, half-carrying the Gleeman. He had thought from the directions that they must have passed the wise woman's house on their way up from the dock that first night. And when he saw the long, narrow house with bunches of herbs hanging in the windows, right next to a potter's shop, he remembered it. Lopar had said something about going to the back door, but he had had enough of mud. And the stink of fish, he thought, frowning at the barefoot men squelching by with their baskets on their backs. There were tracks of horses in the street, too, just beginning to be obliterated by feet and ox carts. Horses pulling a wagon, or maybe a carriage. He had seen nothing but oxen drawing carts or wagons, either one in Tyr. The nobles and the merchants were proud of their fine stock and never let one be put to anything like work. But he had not seen any carriages since leaving the walled city, either. Dismissing horses and wheel tracks from his mind, he took Tom to the front door and knocked. After a time, he knocked again. Then again. He was on the point of giving up and returning to the White Crescent despite Tom coughing on his shoulder when he heard shuffling footsteps inside. The door opened barely more than a crack, and a stout, gray-haired woman peered out.
"What do you want?" she asked in a tired voice.
Matt put on his best grin.
"Light, but I am getting sick myself at all these people who sound like there's no bloody hope. Mother Gwena? My name is Matt Cawthon. Kavan Lopar told me you might do something for my friend's cough. I can pay well."
She studied them a moment, seemed to listen to Tom's wheezes, then sighed.
"I suppose I can still do that, at least. You might as well come in."
She swung the door open and was already plodding toward the back of the house before Matt moved. Her accent sounded so much like the Ammerlin's that he shivered, but he followed,
all but carrying Tom.
I don't need this, the gleeman wheezed. Bloody mixtures always taste like dung.
Shut up, Tom. Leading them all the way to the kitchen, the stout woman rummaged in one of the cupboards, taking out small stone pots and packets of herbs while muttering to herself. Matt sat Tom down in one of the high-backed chairs and glanced through the nearest window. There were three good horses tied out back. He was surprised the wise woman had more than one, or any for that matter. He had not seen anyone in Tyr riding except nobles and the wealthy, and these animals looked as if they had cost more than a little silver. Horses again. I don't care about bloody horses now. Mother Gwenna brewed some sort of strong tea with a rank smell and forced it down Tom's throat, holding his nose when he tried to complain. That decided she had less fat on her than he had thought, from the way she held the gleeman's head steady in the crook of one arm while she poured the black liquid into him, no matter how hard he tried to stop her. When she took the cup away, Tom coughed and scrubbed at his mouth with equal vigor.
Gah, woman, I don't know whether you mean to drown me or kill me with a taste. You ought to be a bloody blacksmith.
You will take the same twice a day till that hacking is gone, she said firmly. And I have a salve that I'll rub on your chest every night. Some of the weariness left her voice as she confronted the gleeman, fists on her broad hips. That salve stinks as bad as this tea tastes, but you will rub it on, thoroughly, or I'll drag you upstairs like a scrawny carp in a net and tie you to a bed with that cloak of yours. I never had a gleeman come to me before, and I'll not let the first one that does cough himself to death. Tom glowered and blew out his mustaches with a cough, but he seemed to take her threat seriously. At least he did not say anything, but he looked as if he meant to throw her tea and her salve right back at her. The more this Mother Gwenna talked, the more she sounded like the Ammerlin to Matt. From the sour look on Tom's face and the steady stare on hers, he decided he had better smooth matters over a little before the gleeman refused to take her medicines. And she decided to make him. I knew a woman once who talked like you, he said. All fish and nets and things. Sounded like you, too. The same accent, I mean. I suppose she's Tyran. Perhaps. The gray-haired woman suddenly sounded tired again, and she kept staring at the floor. I knew some girls with the sound of your speech on their tongues, too. Two of them had it anyway. She sighed heavily. Matt felt his scalp prickle. My luck can't be this good. But he would not bet a copper on two other women with Two Rivers accents just happening to be in Tyr. Three girls. Young women. Named Egwene and Nynaeve and Elaine. That one has hair like the sun and blue eyes. She frowned at him. Those were not the names they gave, she said slowly. Yet I suspected they did not give me their true names. But they had their reasons, I thought. One of them was a pretty girl with bright blue eyes and red-gold hair to her shoulders. She described Nynaeve with her braid to her waist and Egwene with her big, dark eyes and ruddy smile, too. Three pretty women as different from one another as they could be. I see they are the ones you know, she finished. I am sorry, boy. Why are you sorry? I've been trying to find them for days. Light, I walked right past this place the first night. Right past them. I wanted random. What could be more random than where a ship docks on a rainy night, and where you happen to look in a bloody lightning flash? Burn me, burn me. Tell me where they are, Mother Gwenna. The gray-haired woman stared wearily at the stove where her spouted kettle was steaming. Her mouth worked, but she said nothing. Where are they? Matt demanded. It is important. They are in danger if I don't find them. You do not understand, she said softly. You are an outlander. The High Lords... I do not care about any... Matt blinked and looked at Tom. The gleeman seemed to be frowning, but he was coughing so hard Matt could not be sure. What do the High Lords have to do with my friends? You just do not... Don't tell me I do not understand. I will pay for the information. Mother Gwenna glared at him. I do not take money for... She grimaced fiercely. You ask me to tell you things I have been told not to speak of. Do you know what will happen to me if I do and you breathe my name?
I will lose my tongue to begin. Then I will lose other parts before the High Lords have what is left of me hung up to scream its last hours as a reminder to others to obey. And it will do those young women no good, not my telling or my dying. I promise I will never mention your name to anyone. I swear it. And I'll keep that oath, old woman, if you'll only tell me where they bloody are. Please, they are in danger. She studied him for a long time. Before she was done, he had the feeling she knew every detail of him. On that oath, I will tell you. I liked them. But you can do nothing. You are too late, Matrim Cawthon. Too late by nearly 3 hours. They have been taken to the stone. The High Lord Saman sent for them. She shook her head in worried puzzlement. He sent women who could channel. I hold nothing against Aes Sedai myself, but that is against the law. The law the High Lords made. If they break every other law, they would not break that one. Why would a High Lord send Aes Sedai on his errands? Why would he want those girls at all? Matt almost burst out laughing. Aes Sedai, Mother Gwenna, you had my heart in my throat, and maybe my liver, too. If Aes Sedai came for them, there is nothing to worry about. All three of them are going to be Aes Sedai themselves. Not that I like it much, but that's what they... His grin faded at the heavy way she shook her head. Boy, those girls fought like lionfish in a net. Whether they mean to be Aes Sedai or not, those who took them treated them like bilge pumpings. Friends do not give bruises like that. He felt his face twisting. Aes Sedai hurt them? What in the light? The bloody stone. It makes the palace in Camlann look like walking into a barnyard. Burn me! I stood right out there in the rain and stared at this house. Burn me for a bloody light-blinded fool! If you break your hand, Mother Gwenna said, I will splint and poultice it. But if you damage my wall, I will strip your hide like a redfish. He blinked, then looked at his fist, at scraped knuckles. He did not even remember punching the wall. The broad woman took his hand in a strong grip, but the fingers she used to probe were surprisingly gentle. Nothing broken, she grunted after a while. Her eyes were just as gentle as she studied his face. It seems you care for them. One of them, at least. I suppose it is. I am sorry, Matt Cawthon. Don't be, he told her. At least I know where they are now. All I have to do is get them out. He fished out his last 2 Andoran gold crowns and pressed them into her hand. For Tom's medicines, and for letting me know about the girls. On impulse, he gave her a quick kiss on the cheek and a grin. And that's for me. Startled, she touched her cheek, not seeming to know whether to look at the coins or at him. Get them out, you say, just like that, out of the stone. Abruptly, she stabbed him in the ribs with a finger as hard as a tree stub. You remind me of my husband, Matt Cawthon. He was a headstrong fool who would sail into the teeth of a gale and laugh, too. I could almost think you'll manage it. Suddenly, she saw his muddy boots, apparently for the first time. It took me 6 months to teach him not to track mud into my house. If you do get those girls out, whichever of them you have your eye on will have a hard time training you to make you fit to be let inside. You are the only woman who could do that, he said with a grin that broadened at her glare. Get them out. That's all I have to do. Bring them out of the stone of bloody tear. Tom coughed again. He isn't going into the stone like that. Only how do I stop him? Mother Gwenna, can I leave my friend here? I think he is too sick to go back to the inn.
What?
Tom barked. He tried to push himself out of the chair, coughing so he could hardly speak.
I am no such thing, boy. You think walking into the stone will be like walking into your mother's kitchen? You think you would make it as far as the gates without me?
He hung on the back of the chair, his wheezing and hacking keeping him from rising more than halfway to his feet. Mother Gwenna put a hand on his shoulder and pushed him back down as easily as a child. The gleeman gave her a startled look.
I will take care of him, Matt Cawthon, she said.
No, Tom shouted. You cannot do this to me. You can't leave me with this old...
Only her hand on his shoulder kept him from doubling over. Matt grinned at the white-haired man. I've enjoyed knowing you, Tom. As he hurried out into the street, he found himself wondering why he had said that. He isn't going to bloody die. That woman will keep him alive if she has to drag him kicking and screaming out of his grave by his mustaches. Yes, but who is going to keep me alive? Ahead of him, the Stone of Tyr loomed over the city, impregnable, a fortress besieged 100 times, a stone on which 100 armies had broken their teeth. And he had to get inside somehow and bring out 3 women somehow. With a laugh that made even the sullen folk in the street look at him, he headed back for the White Crescent, uncaring of mud or the damp heat. He could feel the dice tumbling inside his head. Chapter 53. A Flow of Spirit. Perrin shrugged into his coat as he walked back toward the star through the evening shadows. A good tiredness soaked through his arms and shoulders. Along with more common work, Master Jala had had him make a large piece of ornamental work, all elaborate curves and scrolls to go on some country lord's new gate. He had enjoyed making something so pretty.
I thought his eyes would come out of his face, blacksmith, when you said you would not make that thing if it was for a high lord.
He glanced sideways at Zareen, walking beside him, the shadows masking her face. Even for his eyes, the shadows were there, just fainter than they would have been for another's. They emphasized her high cheekbones, softened the strong curve of her nose. He just could not make up his mind about her. Even if Moraine and Lan still insisted they stay close to the inn, he wished she could find something else to do besides watch him work. For some reason, he found himself growing awkward whenever he thought of her tilted eyes on him. More than once, he had fumbled with his hammer till Master Ajala frowned at him wonderingly. Girls had always been able to make him feel awkward, especially when they smiled at him. But Zareen did not have to smile. Only look. He wondered again if she was the beautiful woman Min had warned him against. Better if she is the falcon. That thought surprised him so much that he stumbled. I do not want anything I make to get into the hands of one of the Forsaken. His eyes glowed golden as he looked at her. If it was for a High Lord, how could I tell where it might end? She shivered. I did not mean to frighten you, Zareen. She smiled broadly, no doubt thinking he could not see her.
You will fall yet, farm boy. Have you ever thought of wearing a beard?
It is bad enough she's always mocking me, but half the time I do not even understand her. As they reached the front door of the inn, Moraine and Lan met them, coming the other way. Moraine wore that linen cloak with the wide, deep hood that hid her face. Light from the common room windows made yellow pools in the paving stones. 2 or 3 carriages rumbled past, and there were perhaps 12 people in sight, hurrying home for their suppers. But for the most part, shadows populated the street. The weaver's shop was closed tight. The silence was deafening.
Rand is in Tyr.
The Aes Sedai's cool voice issued from the depths of her hood as from a cavern.
Are you sure?
Perrin asked.
I have not heard of anything strange happening. No weddings or wells drying up.
He saw Zareen frown in confusion. Moraine had not been forthcoming with her, and neither had he. Keeping Loyal's tongue silent had been more difficult.
Don't you listen to rumors, blacksmith? The warder said. There have been marriages. As many in the last 4 days as in half a year before. And as many murders as in a whole year. A child fell from a tower balcony today, 100 paces onto stone paving. She got up and ran to her mother without a bruise. The 1st of May, a guest in the stone since before winter, announced today that she will submit to the will of the High Lords after saying yesterday she would see Mayen and all its ships burn before one tyrant country lord set foot in the city. They had not brought themselves to torture her, and that young woman has a will like iron. So you tell me if you think it might be Rand's doing. Blacksmith, from top to bottom, Tyr bubbles like a cauldron.
These things were not needed to tell me, Moraine said. Perrin, did you dream of Rand last night?
Yes, he admitted. He was in the heart of the stone, holding that sword.
He felt Zareen shift beside him. But I have been worrying about that so much, it is no wonder I dream of it. I had nothing but nightmares last night.
A tall man, Zareen said, with reddish hair and gray eyes, holding something that shines so brightly it hurts your eyes, in a place that is all great redstone columns.
Blacksmith, tell me that was not your dream.
You see, Moraine said, I have heard this dream spoken of 100 times today. They all speak of nightmares. Bilal apparently does not care to shield his dreams, but that one above all else.
She laughed suddenly, like low, cool chimes.
People say he is the dragon reborn. They say he is coming. They whisper it fearfully in corners, but they say it.
And what of Bilal? Perrin asked. Moraine's reply was cold-drawn steel.
I will deal with him tonight.
There was no fear sent from her.
We will deal with him tonight, Van told her.
Yes, my Gaideen, we will deal with him.
And what do we do? Sit here and wait? I had enough waiting to last me a lifetime in the mountains, Moraine.
You and Loyal and Zareen will go to Tarvalen, she told him, until this is done. It will be the safest place for you.
Where is the Ogier? Lan said. I want all three of you on your way north as soon as possible.
Upstairs, I suppose, Perrin said. In his room, or maybe the dining room. There are lights in the windows up there. He is always working on those notes of his. I suppose he will have plenty to say in his book about us running away.
He was surprised at the bitterness in his voice.
Light fool, do you want to face one of the Forsaken? No. No, but I am tired of running. I remember not running once. I remember fighting back, and it was better. Even if I thought I was going to die, it was better.
I will find him, Zareen announced. I have no shame in admitting I will be glad enough to run from this fight. Men fight when they should run, and fools fight when they should run. But I have no need to say it twice. She strode ahead of them, her narrow, divided skirts making small whisking noises as they entered the inn. Perrin glanced around the common room as they followed her toward the stairs in the back. There were fewer men at the tables than he expected. Some sat alone with dull eyes, but where two or three sat together, they talked in frightened whispers his ears could barely catch. Even so, he heard dragon three times. As he reached the top of the stairs, he heard another soft sound, a thump as of something falling in the private dining room. He peered that way along the hall.
Zareen?
There was no answer. He felt the hair on the back of his neck shift and patted that way.
Zareen?
He pushed open the door.
Fael!
She was lying on the floor near the table. As he started to rush into the room, Moraine's commanding shout halted him.
Stop, you fool! Stop for your life!
She came along the hallway slowly, head turning as if she were listening for something or searching for something. Lan followed with his hand on his sword, and a look in his eyes if he already knew steel would do no good. She came abreast of the door and stopped.
Move back, Perrin. Move back!
In agony, he stared at Zareen, at Fael. She lay there as if lifeless. Finally, he made himself step back from the door, leaving it open, standing where he could see her. She looked as if she were dead. He could not see her chest stir. He wanted to howl. Frowning, he worked his hand, the one he had used to push the door into the room, opening and closing his fingers. It tingled sharply as if he had struck his elbow.
Aren't you going to do anything, Moraine? If you will not, I am going to her. Stand still, or you will go nowhere, she said calmly. What is that by her right hand? As if it dropped from her grip when she fell. I cannot make it out.
He glared at her, then peered into the room.
A hedgehog. It looks like a hedgehog carved out of wood. Moraine, tell me what is going on. What has happened? Tell me!
A hedgehog, she murmured.
A hedgehog. Be silent, Perrin. I must think. I felt it trigger. I can sense the residues of the flows woven to set it. Spirit. Pure spirit. And nothing else. Almost nothing uses pure flows of spirit. Why does that hedgehog make me think of spirit?
you felt what trigger, Moraine? What was set, a trap?
Yes, a trap, she said, irritation making tiny cracks in her cool serenity. A trap meant for me. I would have been first into that room if Zarina had not rushed ahead. Len and I would surely have gone there to plan and wait for supper. I will not wait on supper now. Be quiet if you wish me to help the girl at all. Lan, bring me that innkeeper.
The warder flowed away down the stairs. Moraine paced up and down in the hall, sometimes stopping to peer through the door from the depths of her hood. Perrin could see no sign that Zareen lived. Her breast did not stir. He tried listening for her heartbeat, but even for his ears it was impossible. When Lan returned, shoving a frightened Jura Harrit ahead of him by the scruff of his fat neck, the Aes Sedai rounded on the balding man.
You promised to keep this room for me, Master Harrit.
Her voice was as hard, as precise, as a skinning knife.
To allow not even a serving woman to enter to clean unless I was present. Who did you let enter it, Master Harrit? Tell me!
Harrit shook like a bowl of pudding.
Only the two ladies, mistress. They wish to leave a surprise for you. I swear, mistress, they showed it to me, a little hedgehog. They said you would be surprised. I was surprised, innkeeper, she said softly.
Leave me!
And if you whisper a word of this, even in your sleep, I will pull this inn down and leave only a hole in the ground. Yes, mistress, he whispered. I swear it. I do swear. Go!
The innkeeper fell to his knees in his haste to reach the stairs and went scrambling down with thumps that suggested he fell more than once as he ran.
He knows I am here, Moraine told the warder. And he has found someone of the Black Aja to set his trap. Yet perhaps he thinks I am caught in it. It was a tiny flash of the power, but perhaps he is strong enough to have sensed it.
Then he will not suspect we are coming, Lan said quietly. He almost smiled. Perrin stared at them, his teeth bared.
What about her? He demanded. What was done to her, Moraine? Is she alive? I cannot see her breathe.
She is alive, Moraine said slowly. I dare not go close enough to her to tell much beyond that, but she is alive. She sleeps, in a way, as a bear sleeps in the winter. Her heart beats so slowly you could count minutes between. Her breathing is the same. She sleeps.
Even from within that hood, he could feel her eyes on him.
I fear she is not there, Perrin. Not in her body any longer.
What do you mean she is not in her body? Light, you don't mean they took her soul, like the Grey Men?
Moraine shook her head, and he drew a relieved breath. His chest hurt as if he had not breathed since she last spoke.
Then where is she, Moraine?
I do not know, she said. I have a suspicion, but I do not know.
A suspicion? A hint? Anything? Burn me where?
Lan shifted at the roughness in his voice, but he knew he would try to break the water like iron over a hardy if the man tried to stop him.
Where?
I know very little, Perrin.
Moraine's voice was like cold, unfeeling music. I have remembered the little I know of what connects a carved hedgehog with spirit. The carving is a Tiran Grial, last studied by Corianna Nadil, the last dreamer the tower had. The talent called dreaming is a thing of spirit, Perrin. It is not a thing I have ever studied. My talents lie in other ways. I believe that Zareen has been trapped inside a dream, perhaps even the world of dreams, till Aranriad. All that is her is inside that dream. All. A dreamer sends only a part of herself. If Zareen does not return soon, her body will die. Perhaps she will live on in the dream. I do not know.
There is too much you don't know, Perrin muttered.
He peered into the room and wanted to cry. Zareen looked so small, lying there, so helpless.
Fail, I swear I will only call you Fail ever again.
Why don't you do something?
The trap has been sprung, Perrin. But it is a trap that will still catch anyone who steps into that room. I would not reach your side before it took me, and I have work I must do tonight.
Burn you, Aes Sedai. Burn your work. This world of dreams, is it like the wolf dreams? You said these dreamers sometimes saw wolves.
I have told you what I can, she said sharply.
It is time for you to go. Lan and I must be on our way to the stone. There can be no waiting now.
No. He said it quietly, but when Moraine opened her mouth, he raised his voice.
No, I will not leave her.
The Aes Sedai took a deep breath.
Very well, Perrin. Her voice was ice, calm, smooth, cold. Remain if you wish. Perhaps you will survive this night.
Lan?
She and the warders strode down the hall to their rooms. In moments they returned, Lan wearing his color-changing cloak, and vanished down the stairs without another word to him. He stared through the open door at Fail.
I have to do something. If it is like the wolf dreams.
Perrin,
came Loyal's deep rumble.
What is this about Fail?
The Ogier came striding down the hall in his shirt sleeves, ink on his fingers and a pen in his hand.
Lan told me I had to go, and then he said something about Fail in a trap. What did he mean?
Distractedly, Perrin told him what Moraine had said.
It might work. It might. It has to.
He was surprised when Loyal growled.
No, Perrin, it is not right. Fail was so free. It is not right to trap her.
Perrin peered up at Loyal's face and suddenly remembered the old stories that claimed Ogier were implacable enemies. Loyal's ears had laid back along the sides of his head, and his broad face was as hard as an anvil.
Loyal, I'm going to try to help Fail, but I will be helpless myself while I do. Will you guard my back?
Loyal raised those huge hands that held books so carefully, and his thick fingers curled as if to crush stone.
No one will pass me while I live, Perrin. Not Myrdral or the Dark One himself.
He said it like a simple statement of fact. Perrin nodded and looked through the door again.
It has to work. I don't care if Min warned me against her or not.
With a snarl, he leaped toward Fail, stretching out his hand. He thought he touched her ankle before he was gone. Whether this dream of the trap was Telaranriad or not, Perrin did not know. But he knew it for the wolf dream. Rolling grassy hills surrounded him and scattered thickets. He saw deer browsing at the edges of the trees, and a herd of some sort of running animal bounding across the grass like brown-striped deer, but with long, straight horns. The smells in the wind told him they were good to eat, and other scents spoke of more good hunting all around him. This was the wolf dream. He was wearing the blacksmith's long leather vest, he realized, with his arms bare. And there was a weight at his side. He touched the axe belt, but it was not the axe hanging from its loop. He ran his fingers over the head of the heavy smith's hammer. It felt right. Hopper alighted in front of him.
Again you come, like a fool.
The sending was of a cub sticking its nose into a hollow tree trunk to lap honey despite the bees stinging its muzzle and eyes.
The danger is greater than ever, young bull. Evil things walk the dream. The brothers and sisters avoid the mountains of stone the two legs pile up, and almost fear to dream to one another. You must go.
No, Perrin said. Fail is here somewhere, trapped. I have to find her, Hopper. I have to.
He felt a shifting inside him, something changing. He looked down at his curly-haired legs, his wide paws. He was an even larger wolf than Hopper.
You are here too strongly.
Every sending carried shock.
You will die, young bull. If I do not free the falcon, I do not care, brother.
Then we hunt, brother.
Noses to the wind, the two wolves ran across the plain, seeking the falcon. Chapter 54. Into the Stone. The rooftops of Tyr were no place for a sensible man to be in the night, Matt decided as he peered into the moon shadows. A little more than 50 paces of broad street, or perhaps narrow plaza, separated the stone from his tiled roof, itself 3 stories above the paving stones. But when was I ever sensible? The only people I ever met who were sensible all the time were so boring that watching them could put you to sleep. Whether the thing was a street or a plaza, he had followed it all the way around the stone since nightfall. The only place it did not go was on the riverside, where the Erinin ran right along the foot of the fortress, and nothing interrupted it except the city wall. That wall was only 2 houses to his right. So far, the top of the wall seemed the best path to the stone, but not one he would be overjoyed to take. Picking up his quarterstaff and a small wire-handled tin box, he moved carefully to a brick chimney a little nearer the wall. The roll of fireworks, what had been the roll of fireworks before he worked on it back in his room, shifted on his back. It was more of a bundle now, all jammed together as tight as he could make it, but still too big for carrying around rooftops in the dark. Earlier, a slip of his foot because of the thing had sent a roof tile skittering over the edge and roused the man sleeping in a room below to bellow, "Thief!" and send him running. He hitched the bundle back into position without thinking about it and crouched in the shadows of the chimney. After a moment, he set the tin box down. The wire handle was beginning to grow uncomfortably warm. It felt a little safer, studying the stone from the shadows, but not much more encouraging. The city wall was not nearly as thick as those he had seen in other places, in Camelin or Tervalen. No more than a pace wide, supported by great stone buttresses cloaked in darkness now. A pace was more than sufficient width for walking, of course, except that the fall to either side was nearly 10 spans. Through the dark to hard pavement. But some of these bloody houses back right up against it. I can make it to the top easily enough. And it bloody runs straight to the bloody stone. It did that, but that was no particular comfort. The sides of the stone looked like cliffs. Eyeing the height again, he told himself he should be able to climb it. Of course I can, just like those cliffs in the mountains of mist. Over 100 paces straight up before there was a battlement. There must be arrow slits lower down, but he could not make them out in the night. And he could not squeeze through an arrow slit. 100 bloody paces. Maybe 120. Burn me, even Rand would not try to climb that. But it was the one way in he had found. Every gate he had seen had been shut tight and looked strong enough to stop a herd of bulls, not to mention the dozen or so soldiers guarding very nearly every last one, in helmets and breastplates, and swords at their belts. Suddenly he blinked and squinted at the side of the stone. There was some fool climbing it, just visible as a moving shadow in the moonlight, and over halfway up already, with a drop of 70 paces to the pavement under his feet. Fool, is he? Well, I'm as big a one because I'm going up too. Burn me, he'll probably raise an alarm in there and get me caught. He could not see the climber anymore. Who in the light is he? What does it matter who he is? Burn me, but this is a bloody way to win a wager. I'm going to want a kiss from all of them, even Nynaeve. He shifted to peer toward the wall, trying to choose his spot to climb, and suddenly there was steel across his throat. Without thinking, he knocked it away and swept the man's feet out from under him with his staff. Someone else kicked his own feet away, and he fell almost on top of the man he had knocked down. He rolled off onto the roof tiles, loosing the bundle of fireworks. If that falls into the street, I'll break their necks. Staff whirling, he felt it strike flesh, and a second time heard grunts. Then there were 2 blades at his throat. He froze, arms outflung. The points of short spears, dull so they hardly caught the faint light of the moon at all, pressed into his flesh just short of bringing blood. His eyes followed them up to the faces of whoever was holding them, but their heads were shrouded, their faces veiled in black except for their eyes, staring at him. Burn me. I have to run into real thieves. What happened to my luck? He put on a grin with plenty of teeth so they could see it in the moonlight. I do not mean to trouble you in your work, so if you let me go my way, I'll let you go yours and say nothing. The veiled men did not move, and neither did their spears. I want no more outcry than you. I'll not betray you. They stood like statues, staring down at him. Burn me, I do not have time for this. Time to toss the dice. For a chilling moment, he thought the words in his head had been strange. He tightened his grip on the quarterstaff, lying out to one side of him, and almost cried out when someone stepped hard on his wrist. He rolled his eyes to see who. Burn me for a fool, I forgot the one I fell on. But he saw another shape moving behind the one standing on his wrist, and decided maybe it was as well he had not managed to bring the staff into use after all. It was a soft boot, laced to the knee, that rested on his arm. It tugged at his memory. Something about a man met in mountains. He eyed the night-cloaked shape the rest of the way up, trying to make out the cut and colors of his clothes. They seemed all shadow, colors that belonged with the darkness too well to see them clearly. Passed a long-bladed knife at the fellow's waist, right up to the dark veil across his face. A black-veiled face. Black-veiled. Aiel! Burn me! What are bloody Aiel doing here? He had a sinking feeling in his stomach as he remembered hearing that Aiel veiled themselves when they killed.
Yes, said a man's voice. We are Aiel.
Matt gave a start. He had not realized he had spoken aloud. You dance well for one caught by surprise, a young woman's voice said. He thought she was the one standing on his wrist. Perhaps another day I will have time to dance with you properly. He started to smile. If she wants to dance, they can't be going to kill me at least. Then frowned instead. He seemed to remember Aiel sometimes meant something different when they said that. The spears were pulled back and hands hauled him to his feet. He shook them away and brushed himself off as if he were standing in a common room instead of on a night-cloaked rooftop with four Aiel. It always paid to let the other man know you had a steady nerve. The Aiel had quivers at their waists as well as knives, and more of those short spears on their backs with cased bows, the long spear points sticking up above their shoulders. He heard himself humming, I'm down at the bottom of the well, and stopped it.
What do you do here? The man's voice asked.
With the veils, Matt was not entirely sure which one had spoken. The voice sounded older, confident, used to command. He thought he could pick out the woman, at least. She was the only one shorter than he, and that not by much. The others all stood a head taller than he or more. Bloody Aiel, he thought. We have watched you for some little time, the older man went on. Watched you watch the stone. You have studied it from every side. Why?
I could ask the same of all of you, another voice said.
Matt was the only one who gave a start as a man in baggy breeches stepped out of the shadows. The fellow appeared to be shoeless, for better footing on the tiles.
I expected to find thieves, not Aiel, the man went on. But do not think your numbers frighten me.
A slim staff no taller than his head made a blur and a hum as he whirled it.
My name is Julin Sandar, and I am a thief-catcher. And I would know why you are on the rooftops, staring at the stone.
Matt shook his head.
How many bloody people are on the roofs tonight?
All that was needed was for Tom to appear and play his harp, or someone to come looking for an inn.
A bloody thief-taker?
He wondered why the Aiel were just standing there.
You stalk well for a city man, the older man's voice said. But why do you follow us? We have stolen nothing. Why have you looked so often at the stone tonight yourself?
Even in the moonlight, this Sandar's surprise was evident. He gave a start, opened his mouth, and closed it again as four more Aiel rose out of the dimness behind him. With a sigh, he leaned on his slender staff.
It seems I am caught myself, he muttered. It seems I must answer your questions.
He peered toward the stone, then shook his head.
I did a thing today that troubles me.
He sounded almost as though he were talking to himself, trying to puzzle it out.
Part of me says it was right, what I did, that I must obey. Surely it seemed right when I did it. But a small voice tells me I betrayed something. I am certain this voice is wrong, and it is very small, but it will not stop.
He stopped then himself, shaking his head again. One of the Aiel nodded and spoke with the older man's voice.
I am Ruark, of the Nine Valleys Sept of the Tardad Aiel. And once I was Aethon Dor, a Red Shield. Sometimes the Red Shields do as your thief catchers do. I say this so you will understand that I know what it is you do and the kind of man you must be. I mean no harm to you, Julin Sandar, of the thief catchers, nor to the people of your city, but you will not be suffered to raise the arm cry. If you will keep your silence, you will live. If not, not.
You mean no harm to the city, Sandar said slowly. Why are you here, then?
The stone. Ruark's tone made it plain that was all he meant to say. After a moment, Sandar nodded and muttered,
I could almost wish you had the power to harm the stone, Ruark. I will hold my tongue.
Ruark turned his veiled face to Matt. And you, nameless youngling, will you tell me now why you watched the stone so closely?
I just wanted to walk in the moonlight, Matt said lightly.
The young woman put her spear point to his throat again. He tried not to swallow.
Well, maybe I can tell them something of it.
He must not let them know he was shaken. If you let the other fellow know that, you lost whatever edge you might have. Very carefully, with two fingers, he moved her steel away from him. It seemed to him that she laughed softly.
Some friends of mine are inside the stone, he said, trying to sound casual. Prisoners. I mean to bring them out.
Alone, nameless one? Ruark said.
Well, there doesn't seem to be anyone else, Matt said dryly. Unless you care to help. You seem interested in the stone yourself. If you mean to go into it, perhaps we could go together. It is a tight roll of the dice any way you look at it, but my luck runs good.
So far, anyway. I've run into Black Veiled Aiel, and they have not cut my throat. Luck cannot get much better than that. Burn me, it would not be bad to have a few Aiel along with me in there.
You could do worse than betting on my luck.
We are not here for prisoners, gambler, Ruark said. It is time, Ruark. Matt could not tell from which of the Aiel that came, but Ruark nodded. Yes, Gaul. He looked from Matt to Sandar and back. Do not give the arm cry. He turned away, and in two steps he had blended into the night. Matt gave a start. The other Aiel were gone too, leaving him alone with the thief-taker.
Unless they left somebody to watch us. Burn me, how could I tell if they did?
I hope you don't mean to try stopping me either, he told Sandar, as he slung the bundle of fireworks on his back again and picked up his quarterstaff. I mean to go inside, by you or through you, one way or the other. He went over to the chimney to pick up the tin box. The wire handle was more than warm now.
These friends of yours, Sandar said. They are three women?
Matt frowned at him, wishing there was enough light to show the man's face clearly. The fellow's voice sounded odd. What do you know of them?
I know they are inside the stone. And I know a small gate near the river where a thief catcher can gain entrance with a prisoner to take him to the cells. The cells where they must be. If you will trust me, gambler, I can take us that far. What happens after that is up to chance. Perhaps your luck will bring us out again alive. I have always been lucky, Matt said slowly. Do I feel lucky enough to trust him?
He did not much like the idea of pretending to be a prisoner. It seemed too easy for pretense to become reality. But it seemed no bigger risk than trying to climb 300 feet or more straight up in the dark. He glanced toward the city wall and stared. Shadows flowed along it, dim shapes trotting. Aiel, he was sure. There must have been over 100. They vanished, but now he could make out shadows moving on the cliff face that was the sheer side of the Stone of Tyr. So much for going up that way. That one fellow earlier might have made it inside without raising an alarm, Ruark's arm cry. But 100 or more Aiel would have to be like sounding bells. That might make a diversion, though. If they caused a commotion somewhere up there, inside the stone, then whoever was guarding the cells might not pay as much attention to a thief-taker bringing a thief.
I might as well add a little to the confusion. I worked hard enough on it.
Very well, thief-taker. Just don't decide I'm a real prisoner at the last minute. We can start for your gate as soon as I stir the anthill a bit.
He thought Sandar frowned, but he did not mean to tell the man more than he had to. Sandar followed him across the rooftops, climbing to higher levels as easily as he did. The last roof was only a little lower than the top of the wall, and ran right up to it, a matter of pulling himself up rather than climbing.
"What are you doing?" Sandar whispered. "Wait here for me."
With the tin box dangling from one hand by its wire handle, and his quarterstaff held horizontally in front of him, Matt took a deep breath and started toward the stone. He tried not to think of how far it was to the pavement below.
"Light, the bloody thing is 3 feet wide. I could walk it with a bloody blindfold in my sleep."
3 feet wide, in the dark, and better than 50 feet to the pavement. He tried not to think about Sandar not being there when he came back, either. He was all but committed to this fool notion of pretending to be a thief caught by the man, but it seemed all too probable that he would return to the roof to find Sandar gone, maybe bringing more men to make him a prisoner in truth.
"Don't think about it. Just do the job at hand.
At least I'll finally see what it is like." As he had suspected, there was an arrow slit in the wall at the stone. Right at the end of the wall, a deep wedge cut into the rock, holding a tall, narrow opening for an archer to shoot through. If the stone were attacked, the soldiers inside would want some way to stop any trying to follow this path. The slit was dark now. There did not appear to be anyone watching. That was something he had tried not to think about, too. Quickly, he set down the tin box at his feet and balanced his quarterstaff across the wall, right against the side of the stone, and unslung the bundle from his back. Hurriedly, he wedged it into the slit, forcing it in as far as he could. He wanted as much of the noise to be inside as he could manage. Pulling aside a corner of the oiled cloth cover revealed knotted fuses. After a little thinking, back in his room, he had cut the longer fuses to match the shortest, using the pieces to help tie all the fuses together. It seemed they should all go off at once, and a bang and a flash like that should be enough to pull everyone who was not completely deaf. The lid of the tin box was hot enough that he had to blow on his fingers twice before he could pry it off. He wished he had whatever Aludra's trick had been, lighting that lantern so easily. To expose the dark bit of charcoal inside, lying on a bed of sand. The wire handle came off to make tongs, and a little blowing had the coal glowing red again. He touched the hot coal to the knotted fuses, let tongs and coal fall over the side of the wall as the fuses hissed into flame, snatched up his quarterstaff, and darted back along the wall.
"This is crazy," he thought as he ran. "I don't care how big a bang it makes. I could break my full neck doing the—"
The roar behind him was louder than anything he had ever heard in his life. A monstrous fist punched him in the back, knocking all the wind out of him even before he landed, sprawled on his belly on the wall top, barely holding on to his staff as it swung over the edge. For a moment he lay there, trying to make his lungs work again, trying not to think how he must have used up all his luck this time by not falling off the wall. His ears rang like all the bells in Tarvalin. Pushing himself up carefully, he looked back toward the stone. A cloud of smoke hung around the arrow slit. Behind the smoke, the shadowed shape of the arrow slit itself seemed different, larger. He did not understand how or why, but it did seem larger. He only thought for a moment. At one end of the wall, Sandar might be waiting, might be intending to take him into the stone as a pretend prisoner, or might be hurrying back with soldiers. At the other end of the wall, there might be a way inside without any chance of Sandar betraying him. He darted back the way he had just come, no longer worrying about the darkness or the drop to either side. The arrow slit was larger, most of the thinner stone at the middle simply gone, leaving a rough hole as if someone had hammered at it with a sledge for hours, a hole just big enough for a man.
How in the light?
There was no time for wondering. He pushed through the jagged opening, coughing at the acrid smoke, jumped to the floor inside, and had run a dozen steps before defenders of the stone appeared, at least 10 of them, all shouting in confusion. Most wore only their shirts, and none had helmet or breastplate. Some carried lanterns. Some held bared swords.
"Fool," he shouted inside his head, "this is why you set the bloody things off in the first place. White-blinded fool!"
He had no time to make it back out onto the wall. Quarterstaff spinning, he threw himself at the soldiers before they had a chance to do more than see he was there. Hurled himself into them, smashing at heads, swords, knees, whatever he could reach. Knowing they were too many for him to handle alone, knowing that his fool toss of the dice had cost Egwene and the others whatever chance he might have had. Suddenly Sandar was there beside him, in the light of lanterns dropped by men clawing for their swords, his slender staff whirling even faster than Matt's quarterstaff. Caught between two staffmen, taken by surprise, the soldiers went down like pins in a game of bulls. Sandar stared at the fallen men, shaking his head.
Defenders of the stone. I have attacked defenders. They all have my head for... What was it that you did, gambler? That flash of light and thunder breaking stone. Did you call lightning?
His voice fell to a whisper.
Have I joined myself to a man who can channel?
Fireworks, Matt said curtly. His ears were still ringing, but he could hear more boots coming, running boots thudding on stone.
The cells, man! Show me the way to the cells before any more get here!
Sandar shook himself.
This way!
He dashed down a side hall, away from the oncoming boots.
We must hurry! They will kill us if they find us!
Somewhere above, gongs began to sound an alarm, and more thundered echoes through the stone.
I'm coming, Matt thought as he ran after the thief-taker. I'll get you out or die, I promise it.
The alarm gongs sent echoes crashing through the stone, but Rand paid no more attention to them than he had to the roar that had come before, like muffled thunder from somewhere below. His side ached. The old wound burned, strained almost to tearing by the climb up the side of the fortress. He gave the pain no heed either. A crooked smile was fixed on his face, a smile of anticipation and dread he could not have wiped away if he had wanted to. It was close now. What he had dreamed of. Kalandor.
I will finish it at last. One way or another, it will be done with. The dreams finished. The baiting and the taunting and the hunting. I'll finish it all.
Laughing to himself, he hurried through the dark corridors of the Stone of Tyr.
Egwene put a hand to her face, wincing. Her mouth had a bitter taste, and she was thirsty. Rand? What? Why was I dreaming about Matt again all mixed with Rand and shouting that he was coming? What? She opened her eyes, stared at the gray stone walls, one smoky rush torch casting flickering shadows, and screamed as she remembered it all. No! I will not be chained again! I won't be collared! No! Nynaeve and Elaine were beside her in an instant, their bruised faces too worried and fearful for the soothing sounds they made to be believed. But just the fact that they were there was enough to still her screams. She was not alone. A prisoner, but not alone. And not collared. She tried to sit up, and they helped her. They had to help her. She ached in every muscle. She could remember every unseen blow during the frenzy that had all but driven her mad when she realized, I will not think about that. I have to think about how we are to escape. She slid backwards until she could lean against a wall. Her pains fought with weariness. That struggle when she had refused to give in had taken every last scrap of her strength, and the bruises seemed to sap even more. The cell was absolutely empty except for the three of them and the torch. The floor was bare and cold and hard. The door of rough planks, splintered as if countless futile fingers had clawed at it, was the only break in the walls. Messages had been scratched in the stone, most by unsteady hands. The light have mercy and let me die, one read. She blanked that out of her head. Are we still shielded? She mumbled. Even talking hurt. Even as Elaine nodded, she realized she had not had to ask. The swollen cheek on the golden-haired woman, her split lip and black eye, were answer enough, even if her own pains had not been. If Nynaeve had been able to reach the true source, they surely would have been healed. I have tried, Nynaeve said despairingly. I have tried and tried and tried. She gave her braid a sharp tug, anger seeping through despite the hopeless fear in her voice. One of them is sitting outside. Amiko, that milk-faced chit, if they have not changed since we were thrown in here. I suppose one is enough to maintain the shielding once it has been woven. She barked a bitter laugh. For all the pains they took and gave to take us, You would think we were of no importance at all. It has been hours since they slammed that door behind us, and no one has come to ask a question, or look, or even bring a drop of water. Perhaps they mean to leave us here until we die of thirst. Wait, Elaine's voice quavered.